but a lovely evening. Great to see the sun. I came to sunny California and it took a couple days before I saw the sun. Wonderful to be here, and I appreciated Scott's remarks. He's an old hand at this. And I very often remember the very first time I was asked to introduce a Christian Science lecturer, because I wasn't nearly so put together. I worried it a lot, and I wrote out 3 or 4 possibilities and looked forward to the time when I could meet with the lecturer, hoping he could give me some pointers. And when I met him, he was a Texan, and he was tall, and his heart was as big as he was, and he was very approachable. And so I asked if he would mind telling me what he thought an introduction should be about. And he said, "Certainly, little lady." And he leaned over and he said, "It should be about 60 seconds. Well, that certainly simplified everything. Our subject tonight has an interesting title. A longer one than is sometimes recommended as a title. But it came to me first as a possible subject that would be helpful after I had read a remark in the New England Journal of Medicine, a remark made by a very prominent American psychologist, Dr. Michael S. Aronoff. He had written, "The majority of people going to outpatient clinics today with bodily complaints are really saying, 'My life hurts.' There's a lot of healing needed in the world today because there's a lot of hurting going on that's unhealed. And the unhealed hurts in our lives lead not only to physical complaints, but also so often unwittingly lead to one individual hurting another. If we look deeply enough into the most insidious kind of thinking that the human mind is capable of, we'll find unhealed hurts. At the bottom of alienation and loneliness and jealousy, envy, crime, abuse, bigotry, hatred, victimization, greed, we will find at the bottom of all of these someone's unrelenting, unhealed hurt. And tonight we're going to be looking at a way of healing life's hurts. We're going to be looking at a method that involves taking a journey. And it's a journey that each one of us will make. It isn't a matter of whether or not we make it. It's just a matter of when. It's a journey that Jesus talks about in one of the stories that he tells. It's a parable. And the definition of a parable is an earthly story with a heavenly meaning. And it's a teaching tool that Jesus often used, telling a story centering around everyday, ordinary happenings in order to teach deep spiritual lessons. The particular story that we're going to be looking at is commonly called the parable of the prodigal. I'm not sure I agree with that title, but it seems to be the one that over the generations has stuck. The story, by brief overview, has to do with a father and 2 sons. The younger son takes his inheritance, and after a period of self-centered living, he decides to return home. And the story looks at the attitude of the younger brother and of the older brother and of the father. In order to get the deep spiritual meaning from the scriptures, we have to realize that the scriptures teach us through symbols. And so tonight, as we look at this parable, we're going to be looking at its metaphysical import, because Christian Science is a metaphysical system. The word metaphysical has a very simple definition. Meta, M-E-T-A, means above or outside or beyond the physical. So in order to get the deep spiritual meaning, we're not going to be looking at the mere literal story, but we're going to go beyond, outside of, and above that, to get the spiritual meaning, and we're going to be looking at symbols. Now, there's a key in this parable that helps us unlock the deep spiritual truth. The key is found in the very last sentence uttered in this parable, and it's stated by the Father. And it's this, and we need to know this up front because it's going to help us unlock the deeper meaning that's in this parable. The statement is made by the Father, and it's this: Son, thou art ever with me, and all that I have is thine. So we need to know that together up front as we look at the story. Our talk tonight has two parts. The first part will deal with the parable itself, line by line, as we look at the symbols there and to see what message Jesus is communicating. The second part of the story will show us how we can use the spiritual truth that's presented in this parable, how it applies today to your life and my life in healing the hurts in our lives and in our bodies, ours and those of around us whom we love and care deeply about, and even the world itself that we care deeply about in our communities and our nations. But before we get into the parable, by way of introduction, it will be helpful for us to just realize together that when the Bible uses the word man, it presents three different viewpoints or concepts of man when that word is used. And it's helpful for us to realize this so we understand which viewpoint of man is being discussed. For instance, in the best-known creation story, the Adam and Eve creation story, there is a viewpoint of man that's presented as a material being. Adam's made from dust, matter, Eve from his rib, matter. And we find as we look at that story that this is a self-centered, material, mortal, limited viewpoint of man. And as that story closes, we read words like sweat and toil and pain and labor. And there's expulsion and alienation. That's one viewpoint of man. This is the viewpoint that when Paul, in his Christian teachings, is offering instruction to the followers of Christ Jesus, he said, this is the man that must be put off. He refers to this man as the carnally minded man or the mortal or materially minded man. That's one viewpoint. Now, there's another viewpoint of man that's illustrated in the lesser known creation story in the first chapter of Genesis. Adam and Eve is in the second and third chapter. In the first creation story, man is presented not as made from matter, but as made in the image and likeness of God. God being spirit, this man is a spiritual being. It's a God-centered being. And this is the man that Paul urges us to put on. So that's the second viewpoint of man. Now, there appears to be another viewpoint that seems to be somewhere in the middle. And this is the one that responds to the teachings of Christ Jesus. This is the one, you might say, that does the putting off and the putting on. So we're going to remember that there are three viewpoints of man presented. And the reason this is so very important as a key into our discussion tonight is that it is a profound truth that whatever viewpoint of man we accept at any given moment directly determines our experience, even our well-being. And I'm going to illustrate that by doing something that I've never done in a lecture until this one, and I didn't even do it at first in this one, and that's to tell a joke. I find a lot of humor in life, but I don't tell many jokes. But this one really makes the point, and I wasn't going to tell it because it's such an old joke that I was sure everybody would have heard it. And then one evening I tried it, and it's such an old joke that few people have heard it. But it makes a point, and here's our little story. It has to do with a man traveling very late at night in a rural area. And he gets a flat tire. And he thinks, no problem, I've got a good spare, I'll put the spare on, and I'll be on my way in no time. But when he opens the trunk, he finds his jack isn't there. And he looks down the road and he sees a farmhouse with a light in the window and he thinks, no problem, farmers have jacks, they have tools of all kinds. I'll borrow a jack and I'll put on my spare and I'll soon be on my way. And he starts walking down the road to the farmhouse. And as he walks, the first thing that happens is he realizes how very late it is. And he starts reasoning through that farmers work hard, they arise very early in the day. The farmer's probably in bed and he's going to awake him. The light is probably in the window for somebody else in the family, and the farmer's going to get woken up and he's going to be angry. And he's going to think that I'm pretty stupid for not having a jack. Farmer's going to be angry and he's going to be disgusted with me and he's going to think I'm stupid. And the closer he gets to the house, the more he thinks like this. And he finally gets to the house and he knocks on the door and the farmer opens it and the man blurts out, you can just keep your darn old jack. The viewpoint of man that he had built up in his consciousness directly affected not only his thinking, but the very words that came out of his mouth. And that nice man is taking care of the air conditioning for us. You'll all be happy to know that. And if anyone's too warm now, or if at any time you're too warm, please feel free to take your jacket off. Anyone want to do that now? You're warm? If you get warm, I don't hesitate. Just please be comfortable. But I think we're going to have some air.
We hope.
On a deeper level, looking a little further is how what we accept as valid as a viewpoint of ourselves affecting our experience. I read some very interesting research that's taking place now in the medical field regarding multiple personality individuals, like the three faces of Eve. This is an individual who seems to have within the same body several different personalities who at different times become dominant. And the medical faculty is researching this because what they have found is when personality A in a body is dominant, that personality needs heavy corrective lenses in order to read. But when within the same body another personality, say personality B, becomes dominant, that one can read fine print without any glasses at all. They have found that as different personalities become dominant, there may be a tumor in one, diagnosable. These are not imaginary. There may be diseases. There may be allergies. They can even be different elements in the bloodstream that change when a different personality becomes dominant. One, for instance, there was a personality that had felt themselves, considered themselves to be an elderly aunt, and had severe crippling arthritis, diagnosable in the medical field. But when another personality who was much younger became dominant in the same body, there was no evidence whatsoever of the arthritis. Very interesting research underscoring that viewpoint of man that we hold valid at any given moment will directly impact our experience, our thinking, and even our physical well-being. Now, this is basic to our discussion, so this is just by way of background. Now, let's look at our story. This is recorded in the 15th chapter of Luke. And again, we're going to be looking at the symbols. The Father in this story symbolizes God. Now, in Jesus' ministry, a little bit of background here, he found that the Jewish traditional viewpoint of God was that as a wrathful, revenging, punishing, angry God who arbitrarily dispensed good to some and withheld it from others. And Jesus came presenting an altogether different viewpoint of God. God as a loving parent, our Father. And this was a radical new viewpoint of God. Jesus found he had a great challenge before him in presenting his kingdom as a spiritual kingdom, because the Hebrews were expecting a Messiah who would save them, and they were expecting it to be in a material way. They thought that when the Messiah came, he would set up a human material kingdom, and he would punish all of the opponents for all the injustices they had experienced for centuries, and this is what they were expecting. So this is why they had trouble accepting Jesus as the Messiah. And we see in this series of teaching that over and over, Jesus is trying to establish a spiritual kingdom and a heavenly Father who is love. And there's a whole series in his discourse where he'll say, and again the kingdom of heaven is like unto. And they didn't quite understand, so he'll say, and again it is like unto. And that's what parables are all about, is he's trying to teach the nature of the kingdom and the nature of God as Father. And this is one that's bringing out the nature of God as Father. Now we know from the story that this Father is a Father of substance. He has land. He has fields, and he has servants, employees. A certain man had two sons, our parable begins. And the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the portion of goods that falleth to me. And right now we see something about how this younger son viewed himself, because he asked for a portion. Now remember that key sentence that the father states at the end, Son, thou art ever with me, and all that I have is thine. Allness is the measure in the father's house. It's not a limited portion, it's all. It's inexhaustible, it's unlimited, it can never run out. And a portion is just the opposite. It's a limited amount, and while it may have seemed like a great deal to our young son, our younger brother, a portion still is limited. It will be exhausted. It will run out. And so we see that he's not thinking of himself as the spiritual being, the son of the Heavenly Father, who is good, we're reading this, but he's thinking of himself more in the terms of being a mortal who can experience limitation. Good won't be all. And he asks for his portion, and that's a clue there as to how he's viewing himself. Now we see something about the Father, and he divided unto them his living. Here's this God who is good, and he's universal. The older brother didn't ask for his, but this Father is fair, and he gives to each of them their inheritance. And not many days after, the younger son gathered all together and took his journey into a far country. Now, the far country is not a geographical location, because this isn't a real story. But he's going into a place that is far removed from the atmosphere or the attitude that is in the Father's house. When we start thinking of ourselves not in the realm of I have, but rather in the realm of I want, that's about as far from the Father's house as we can go. So we see a separation here that's a mental misconception. And in this far country, he wasted his substance with riotous living. I don't know how many of you teach in the Sunday school. I happen to love the job. And one Sunday I had a class of 6, 7, and 8-year-old boys. And this lesson was to be discussed that morning. And I asked them what they thought it meant when we read the phrase, he wasted his substance with riotous living. And they thought for a while. And finally one boy spoke up and he said, I think that's when you spend your entire allowance on baseball cards. I found he had done that, and he'd gotten in a little bit of trouble. And you know, I think that's a wonderful answer. Because when you're a 6 or 7 or 8-year-old boy, having the right baseball card gives you a wonderful sense of importance, and you want the right baseball card. If you have the right baseball card, all the kids want to come to your house and see it. If you have several, they like to barter, and all of a sudden you have a popularity, you have an importance, you have a prestige, and you have a sense of happiness and fulfillment that you didn't have before. Only when you're 6 and 7 and 8, what you want perhaps is the right baseball card. Now, it's the wanting thing. I think that the prodigal undoubtedly had a different agenda. But the thinking was the same. He thought by taking his portion and spending it on those things that he thought he wanted, he could be more successful, he could be popular, he could be well thought of because he's spreading out a lot of money, and that always brings friends and attracts friends. And in all of this, he thought he was going to gain a sense of fulfillment and popularity and prestige by pursuing the things that he wanted. When he had spent all, because it was only a portion, there arose a mighty famine in that land, and he began to be in want. That which he had accepted as the want kind of thinking led him directly to being in want. You might call the land of I want. Everyone in that country was in want because the famine spread across the entire land. There's a hunger. There's a lack of feeling filled full or fulfilled in the land of I want. And he was desperate. He went and he joined himself to a citizen of that country. He's thinking, maybe I really belong here. And the citizen sent him into his fields to feed swine. Now we need to remember, this is a young man from the Hebrew tradition. And the pigs, the swine, were loathsome, unclean, repugnant creatures. And here he was having to take care of them and feed them. And he was so empty, he would fain have filled his belly with the husks that the swine did eat, and no man gave unto him. Now that's really desperation. You can't get any lower than that. The husks were carob husks, coarse, unsuitable for human consumption, but he was so empty and hungry that he would have, if he could have eaten those husks. And at this very, very low point, we find himself remembering a different viewpoint of man. It says, and when he came to himself, he's remembering there's a different kind of selfhood than the one I've accepted here. And he remembers. He said, how many hired servants of my father's have bread enough and to spare, and I perish with hunger. Again, we're learning something about the father. He was a good father. He treated his servants very, very well. They had enough and to spare, and he's remembering this great love and generosity that is in the father's house. And he makes a decision. He says, I will arise and go to my father. And then he does something I think is so dear. He practices what he's going to say. And we've all done that. We wanted to go in and ask for a couple of days off. Maybe we'd like to talk about the raise that we were promised that nobody's mentioned for a long time. Maybe there's been a misunderstanding between family members or between good friends, and we'd really like to open up the subject so we can get some healing and some communication restored into some very precious relationships. And we practice what we're going to say. We say, well, I could say it this way. We think about it. Well, maybe it'd be better if I said it this way. And we practice a little bit what we're going to say, reaching out for the best way. And here we have our young man practicing. He said, I will say unto him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before thee. Now he's recognizing, and this is important, that what he's done has been the wrong way. But we want to look at this word sin a little bit here, because over the generations, an awful lot of baggage has been attached to that word that really doesn't necessarily have to be there. The original word sin came from the word archery, or the sport archery, and it literally means to miss the mark. That's what sin is. It means you didn't make the goal. You took the wrong road, or you missed the mark. It doesn't mean that, it doesn't imply that there needs to be an acceptance of condemnation. Father, I have sinned against heaven and before thee. And then you see what follows, and we see here's what happens when we don't understand the nature of sin. He immediately assumes an attitude of unworthiness, and he says, and I am no more worthy to be called thy son. And we need to understand, this story teaches us so much about sin and how the Father viewpoints sin. He says, but he's accepted this sense of unworthiness, and he's going home with this sense of unworthiness, and he practices saying, make me as one of thy hired servants. Now, he wants to go home. He remembers how good the servants had it, and he doesn't feel worthy, and he's willing to go home as a servant. Now, Bible scholars tell us that this little phrase is a very important phrase. They feel that Jesus put it in the story to caution his followers against a servant mentality. A servant is one who does something in order to get something. They have a job description, and they have to do these certain things in order to get their housing or their food or their pay. And sometimes, unwittingly, we approach our Christian living in that way. We go to church regularly in order to be assured that we will get into the kingdom of heaven, doing something to get something. We may awake early in the morning to study our Bible and to pray in order to get a good day. But Bible scholars feel that Jesus was cautioning against that attitude. In the Father's house, as a son, you already have all. And a son does all these things out of a sense of joy and out of a sense of love for the family and the household and the business. And the servants, they already have all. They don't do anything in order to get, because they already have it. And that's kind of what this story is all about. How we need to watch that we don't accept the viewpoint of man that is unworthy and has to perfunctorily go through doing a life of Christian living in order to get into the kingdom of heaven, when Jesus assured us the kingdom of heaven is at hand and within now. So we want to think about that. But at this point in our story, he's willing to go home, and he's going to be willing to go home as a servant. When I gave this lecture down in Florida, a good friend of mine who's a Baptist was there, and her father is a Baptist minister. And she told me after the lecture that this parable was the basis for one of his most favorite sermons. And she said he titled it, Say Goodbye to the Pigs. I think that's a wonderful title. I wish I had thought of it. And we see this is what's happening. Our young man literally says goodbye to the pigs, because we read he arose and came to his father. And when he was yet a great way off, his father saw him and had compassion and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. I asked my class, how do you think the father could see him when he was still a long way off? How could that be? And one boy right away said he had binoculars. Pretty good for a 20th century answer. But I love these answers because it gives you an opportunity to explain that the teachings of Christ Jesus are centuries old. They're eternal. They have a nowness and in application, just as they did then. And it's a fun opening to explain all the things they didn't have then and help them realize the eternal nature of the Christ message. Another boy thought for a while. He had recently been on an outing with his family when he had done some hill climbing, and he said, I know the father was on a hill, because when you're on a hill, you can see a long ways down into the valley. Now, that's very good reasoning, except if you know the geography and the biblical lands, the top of the mountains were windblown and rocky. The fertile land was in the valleys, just as we find here. That's where the fertile land is, and this is where there would have been great fields and servants and household. And so we had to dismiss the fact that the father might have been high on a hill or a mountain. Opportunity to have them think a little bit about the metaphysical teachings in these stories. I asked them to just kind of recount a little bit of what they knew about God. And before long, there was the remembering that God is ever-present, omnipresence. And how does that apply if this Father symbolizes the Son? Had the Father ever left the Son? As soon as the Son turned his thought homeward or Godward, God, he could feel the response of his loving Father because the Father never left the Son. The separation was only in the Son's thought when he began thinking of himself as a limited material or mortal being. And we see that the Father never saw him as leaving because there is no sense of unworthiness in the Father's thought. He doesn't stand at the door tapping his foot, waiting for that Son to humbly approach the door and then finally say to him, "Do you know how much grief you've caused your mother?" There's none of that. He's running out. There's this incredible welcome, the embrace and the kiss, and in the Mideast, the kiss is the symbol of reconciliation. And there is this unconditional, all-embracing, incredible love that never saw the Son as leaving and never saw him as less than the Son. The Son said to him, it's a little speech that he practiced, and here it comes. "Father, I have sinned against heaven and in thy sight, and am no more worthy to be called thy son." Period. A little bit about servants. Kind of slipped by the wayside, I think, when he felt that wonderful, all-embracing, unconditional love. Now, involved in Christian theology with the consideration of sin is repentance. But again, in its original definition, repentance simply means to make a 180-degree turn. And the Son had done that. He had acknowledged that he had missed the road, he had missed the mark. The things that he tried didn't give him that wonderful sense of filled fullness and fulfillment that he thought it would. And he was empty, and he turned and made an abrupt turn and went back in his thinking Godward. And there's no room for condemnation or unworthiness in this approach. There's nothing said about being a servant. But, oh, the Father's love just continues to pour out as he says to the servants, "Bring forth the best robe and put it on him." Scholars say this is the festive robe of honor. There's to be a festivity, and this is to be the guest of honor. "And put a ring on his hand." This is the signet ring that symbolizes this is the son of this household. "And shoes on his feet." I think this is so dear because the servants went barefoot. He'd never said anything to the Father about being willing to be a servant, but the Father wasn't going to let him step into the house without his shoes because this was not a servant. This was the Son. "Bring hither the fatted calf." The fatted calf was a special piece of livestock, often used for religious ceremonies. This is such an important occasion. "Let us eat and be merry, for this my son was dead." He had died to who he really was, but is alive again. He's the son. He was lost. He lost sight of the correct viewpoint of himself. But he has found it. He is found. And they began to be merry. A wonderful party. What a wonderful ending to this story. We love our stories to have happy endings. And that's why so many people, when they tell the story of the parable, and before I was a Christian Scientist, I heard many sermons. I was very active in my church. Many sermons on the parable of the prodigal, and it ends right here. Even in my own study, I have found from time to time the story ends here. And I always say, how can they do that? Because it starts out, a certain man had two sons. There's something to be told. There's something to be learned. That's why I'm not really sure it should be called the parable of the prodigal. But we understand why we like to end it here, because it is such a happy ending. In fact, I have a very good friend who's a Methodist, and she is a good friend because she lets me practice on her. And she'll be very candid, and she'll tell me, Frankly, my mind wandered during that discussion. You didn't hold my thought very well. Or she'll say, your terms are a little confusing. You need to do some explaining or something. So she's very, very helpful. And I was telling her that I was putting together this talk on the prodigal of the parable, the parable of the prodigal. And her face kind of got all scrunchy, and she said, I don't like that story. That's my least favorite story in the whole Bible. And I said, why? And she said, it seems to me like it's very unfair. And I think we can understand that. I thought about it, and we talked a little bit. And if you read this story in its sheer literal interpretation, it is unfair. And the older brother doesn't seem to come out very well. But if you realize that this whole story is being taught in symbols in order to teach us valuable lessons, spiritual lessons that will help us in healing the hurts in our lives, then we don't see any sense of injustice or unfairness. We just see the lessons. Now, the story continues. Now, his elder son was in the field. And as he came and drew nigh to the house, he heard music and dancing. There's a party going on. There was no party planned this morning, and he's coming back in. And now, we can picture this. He's worked hard, possibly all day, hot, dirty, tired, hungry. He'd just like to go in and get washed up and have a little bit to eat. And there's a party going on. And he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And the servant said unto him, thy brother is come, and thy father hath killed a fatted calf, because he hath received him safe and sound. Isn't that good news? Was it good news? Did our elder brother rush in and say, where is he? I'm so glad he's finally got his act together. I'm so glad he's home. We got a lot of catching up to do, brah. Is this what he did? Anybody remember the word? He was angry. He was angry and would not go in. Then look at this, something more about the father. Therefore came his father out and entreated him. The father always comes to where we are. There is never any separation, and this shows that here's the father out, and he's reasoning with him. And he's saying, come on in. And the elder brother answers to his father, lo, these many years do I serve thee, neither transgressed I, oh my, we're seeing an awful lot of self here, neither transgressed I at any time thy commandment, and yet thou never gavest me a kid, little sarcasm here, kid's a baby goat, thou never gavest me a little baby goat that I could have a party, make merry with my friends. But as soon as this, watch this, he's even about to acknowledge, this is my brother. He's had it with this kid brother of his who never did a lick of work in his life. And he said, as soon as this thy son, he's no brother of mine, as soon as this thy son was come, which hath devoured thy living with harlots, God's substance is inexhaustible. It is unlimited. It can never be devoured. But as soon as he's come home, you've killed for him the fatted calf. And what do we see here? We see a meanness. We see a meanness that comes out of a misunderstanding. Our elder brother never left home, but he never understood what it was to be a son. He's thinking of himself somewhere over here, doing all the right things, maybe for all the wrong reasons. Jewish tradition is that the elder son gets a double portion. This was fulfilling Jewish tradition. He got twice as much as his younger brother got. I don't think there were money market funds in those days. But he could have been drawing some interest. They had interest-bearing activities. Surely he didn't have to spend much. He probably had everything that had been given to him because he'd still been being fully provided by the father. He has it all. His good was never touched. But when we don't understand that we are the son, we'll think there's not enough good to go around. And if we start believing there isn't enough good to go around, then we start being really concerned about how much good somebody else has. And we find the seeds for envy and meanness and jealousy and pettiness. And there's no forgiveness here at all. All of these awful kinds of thinking that just go deep into us, bringing the hurts in our lives, leading to the hurts in our bodies and in our actions. He never left home, but he never fully understood. And it's at this point that the father says, not to the younger brother, but to the elder brother, showing forth that same all-embracing, unconditional love. You can just see him looking at him and saying, "You don't understand. Son, thou art ever with me, and all that I have is thine. If you only remember one thing out of tonight's talk, if you go home and remember it before you go to bed and think of it in the morning and during the day and next week and next month, if you remember this, our talk tonight will have been very, very successful for you and for me. Son, daughter, thou art ever with me, and all that I have is thine." This was central to Jesus' entire ministry. All the way through his ministry, over and over and over, he was saying, "My God, your God, our God. My God, your God, our God. My Father, your Father, our Father." That was the central theme of his ministry. Paul caught it. We find it over and over in his writings. Glimpses. He could write, "We are heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ." And the beloved disciple John said, "Beloved, now are we the sons of God." Not someday in the hereafter, if we're good enough, if we do all these nice little church activities well enough, maybe then we will be the son. Not someday over the rainbow, but now are we the sons of God. And when we're holding that viewpoint of ourselves in our lives, we begin to find healing for our physical complaints, for our human relationships, we find the log jams in our life loosening up. And we find healing for alienation and victimization, for loneliness and abuse. And I'd like to illustrate that now. I'm going to start out by first discussing a very narrow subject of healing, and then we'll get into larger area as we illustrate it. But first I'd like to talk about immunity, because it's certainly something that's on our thoughts, in the news. When I was being trained to be a medical assistant, I learned that from the medical viewpoint, there are two different kinds of immunity. There is an acquired immunity and a natural immunity. Acquired immunity has to do with that experience when someone has had a specific disease. And sometimes, not always, there will be a resistance present in the body, and that individual will not get that specific disease again. That's acquired immunity. An inoculation or a vaccination is an injection into the body of a mini form of a specific disease, and as a result, sometimes but not always, that individual will have a resistance to that specific disease. That's acquired immunity. Now, natural immunity is altogether different, and it has to do with the species. For instance, a goldfish can't catch measles. Children can be in their most contagious stages of measles, and they can change the water, they can feed the fish, they can take them out in a little net, and nobody's worried about them catching measles because goldfish can't catch measles. A farmer can take care of his sick pigs, and the vet can say it's hog cholera, And nobody's worried about the farmer catching that disease because only pigs can get that. It has to do with the species. Are you with me? Now, a landowner can cut down a diseased elm tree, Dutch elm disease. I don't know if you have that out here. We have that a lot in our area. And he can cut it into firewood size. He can slice it up. He can carry it, stack it behind the garage or the barn. Every evening and every spare weekend, for several weeks while he's taking care of that tree, nobody's worried about him catching Dutch elm disease because he isn't a tree. Now, the real man, made in the image and likeness of God, this spiritual viewpoint of man is no more a mortal than he is a tree. A mortal is condemned to having disease, not only contagious disease, but all kinds of sorrows and sufferings and pains and toils and travails. That was the curse put upon the material viewpoint of man. But man, made in the image and likeness of God, the spiritual man, is no more a mortal than he is a tree, and because of that, he has a natural immunity to any kind of disease. But he has to know it. He has to accept that as valid about himself. But when he does, healing results. Example, when my older boys, I have five children, by the way, and when the two boys were little, they were invited for a neighborhood sleepover birthday party. I've never understood why they call those sleepovers. They came home mid-morning on Saturday. The party was Friday night, and they were just beat, and they went to their rooms and crashed and had a happy time. And a little after lunchtime, they were still asleep, I got a call from the birthday boy's mother. Her child had become very ill. They had called a doctor, and he had diagnosed a highly communicable disease, and this child had a very serious case of it. And he told the mother she had to call all the mothers there so that the mothers of the guests could get medical help because this was serious, and he wanted us all to be alerted in time that on Saturday we could find our medical help and get the children cared for. Well, now, Christian Scientists don't use medical help, not because there's any antagonism or hostility, but simply because they have a viewpoint of man that brings healing through spiritual means. And I thanked her because I was certainly glad to know we don't ignore problems. I was glad to know this. But it was an opportunity for prayer. And I don't even remember stopping my household chores. Whatever I was doing, I went right on that with them. But I was thinking about my children as not being mortals or trees, but understanding that they were the very image and likeness of God, spiritual and totally exempt, having a God-given immunity from all of the trials that mortals are heir to. And when I finished really drawing close in my realization about that, I prayed the bigger prayer and just recognized that was the truth about every child in the party, including the birthday boy. There aren't those that have and those that have not. There's only God's child. And that's the only valid viewpoint of man that I accept. My children never had any symptoms whatsoever, didn't miss any school, and I found that none of the children at the party did. Sunday afternoon, I called the birthday boy's mother, offering to help, because she certainly seemed burdened on Saturday, and I thought maybe by then she could use an extra pair of hands, and she said he's doing so much better. And the doctor couldn't quite explain it, but he ended up only missing a couple of days of school. Praying the bigger prayer, accepting the validity of man as the very child of God, brought an exemption, an immunity, and even, I feel, some contribution towards the healing of that dear little boy. It's easy, it's fun. The children learn it early on to say we're no more immortal than we are a tree. They seem to grasp that concept. But it isn't enough just to say it. It has to be lived, and it, to the best of our ability. None of us can live wholly the spiritual life. We do it as in degrees as we accept this viewpoint and understand it better. We live it a little more clearly. That's what spiritual progress is all about. But it is important that we live it the best we understand it. And I'll illustrate with another example. I was hurrying to get the house in order before I left for the office. And I remember going into the boys' room and scurrying up the bunk bed ladder. And as I did, there was a little voice that said, "Check the ladder." And I was in a hurry. I had a lot to do, and every other day it had been fine. And I hurried up the ladder, and as I reached over to the far point part of the bed to smooth it over, the ladder was pushed away from the bed in some kind of a leverage principle. Down it went, crashing on toys, and I was with the ladder, my foot tangled, one of them in the rungs, and I heard snapping across the instep of my foot of bones as I went down. I wasn't particularly concerned. I expected a very quick healing because I've seen very quick healings, even of broken bones, by understanding this viewpoint of man, and I expected a very quick healing. As I hopped away from the bedroom, I grabbed a towel from the bathroom, I went into the living room, propped up the wounded foot, covered it with a towel. Not because of a desire to have an ostrich-like approach to this healing and hide myself from the facts, but because Christian Science is a metaphysical system, I wanted to keep my thought focused on the metaphysical import of God in man, not upon the physical. So I covered the foot so I could keep the focus of my attention where it belonged, and I prayed. And I'd like to illustrate somewhat what was the central focus of my prayers. I'm reading from the foundational writing in Christian Science, a book entitled Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures. After Mrs. Eddy has presented the full discussion, the full presentation of the theology of Christian Science very thoroughly, very carefully, she summarizes in a little chapter called Recapitulation. In this, through the technique of questions and answers, it's a good teaching tool, she gives concise summaries to all of the basic theological points in Christian Science. And in this chapter, there is the question, what is man? The answer is 2.5 pages. And I'm going to share with you a very small part of the very first part of this answer to show you what was the basic focus of my prayers that morning for healing. Question, what is man? Answer, man is not matter. He is not made up of brain, blood, bones, and other material elements. That's this viewpoint of man. The scriptures inform us that man is made in the image and likeness of God. Matter is not that likeness. The likeness of spirit cannot be so unlike spirit. Man is spiritual and perfect, and because he is spiritual and perfect, he must be so understood in Christian Science. Now, if you've never heard man presented in that kind of a terms before, I know how radical it sounds. I know how radical it sounded the first time I read that. It's a radical viewpoint of man, but it's this very radical viewpoint of man in the image and likeness of God that enables us to experience the kind of radical healings that Christian Science treatment is capable of. And I wanted a radical healing. And I went all the way over to identifying myself in these terms, knowing that God governed my life. And because he governed, I could never be outside of his care. I could never be a victim of an accident, even though that's what appeared to have taken place. I prayed out from all I understood along these terms for over an hour with no results at all. The foot was getting more and more painful. I could feel the swelling increase. And because James tells us in his discussion of prayer, you pray and your prayers aren't answered because you pray amiss, I stopped and I just felt it was time for me to really kind of listen to what inspiration might come from God, from my understanding of what God was, and I remember just saying, "Father, what is it? What am I not seeing here?" And I listened. I listened for that inspiration, for that spiritual direction I didn't hear anything except what was going on at the back of my mind, way far back, and it evidently had been going on all the time, and I'd been so busy praying that I hadn't heard it. But it was loud and clear when I stopped to listen, and it went something like this. That was really stupid. I should have checked the ladder. There was a reminder to check the ladder. Why didn't I check the ladder? I was disobedient. I know enough to follow and act upon those little intuitions, and I didn't. Why was I so disobedient? Well, because I'm in a hurry. I'm always in a hurry. I always have too much to do. There's always too much to do, and there's never enough time to do it in, and I never get enough help. Sound familiar, Mother? And all of that was going on. I felt myself condemned, unworthy, because I was stupid, and I was disobedient, and I was hurried. You see, all the selves, I mean, it sounded a little bit like the elder brother with all the selves. You know, whenever we get involved in self-importance, in self-justification, we're going to have to wear that garment on the inside out, which is self-pity, the flip side. Self-pity, inadequacy, is always the flip side of the record of self-importance and self-justification and so forth. And here I was with the self-pity, the self-importance. I had so much to do. Never enough time to do it in, and I heard all of that pouring out, and there is nothing consistent about that viewpoint of man and that beautiful viewpoint of man that I've been praying about for an hour. And it isn't enough to say the words. There was a greater healing that needed to take place, and I started addressing that. Further on down in this answer to the question, what is man, are a few sentences that became the focal point for my prayer from then on. Man, this is the real name, is incapable of sin, sickness, and death. That's certainly how the father viewed the prodigal and the older brother. He didn't view them as sinful or unworthy or condemning. Man is incapable of sickness, sin, and death. The real man cannot depart from holiness, nor can God, by whom man is evolved, engender the capacity or freedom to sin. A mortal sinner is not God's man, and neither is a burdened, overworked, tired, frustrated, self-pitying mother. That's not God's man, and neither is the burdened, overworked, with such responsibility for taking care of college educations and so forth, father, or retirement years, or whatever. Neither is God's man, because man is spiritual and perfect. He must be so understood. So I turned my prayers addressing this viewpoint of man as a burdened, mortal, overworked, unappreciated, etc. And I started thinking about the motherhood of God. Jesus came presenting the fatherhood of God. And all through the Bible, there is ample substantiation for the concept of the motherhood of God. But Mrs. Eddy in Christian Science courageously articulated that as Father, Mother, God, the complete parent who not only protects and provides in that strong masculine way, but nourishes and comforts with that gentle intuition and care that we associate with motherhood. Father, Mother, God. And at this point I started thinking about mothering, because that's where the burden was. And I started being grateful. First thing I thought of was, does God have too many children? And of course the answer is no. Is God ever too busy? Is he ever taking care of some and neglecting others? No. This supreme love that is all present, ever present, its supreme intelligence, which is love, takes care of all his children. And I started remembering all of the times when I had experienced that mothering. The times when I felt that I literally been picked up when I stumbled and stood on my feet and with a gentle encouragement, encouraged to go on forward and not ruminate over mistakes made. All the times I'd felt the tears wiped away. All the times I had felt the comforting, presence, all the times I had felt love when I felt so unlovable. Sometimes when you're a mother, all you do is, when you have kids and a dog and a cat, all you think you do is clean up messes. And if you'll permit me this analogy, I thought of all the times that I felt God had cleaned up the messes in my life, had washed me clean and set me on the path and said, it's all right, go forward. This uncondemning, unconditional, all-accepting, all-embracing love that never sees us other than his beloved child. And I just kind of gloried in that with such gratitude that it seemed unspeakable. And as I was praising God and thanking him and realizing something I'd known before that I'd lost sight of, that our only responsibility at any given time is to respond to God's ability and the awareness of his magnificent ability to father and mother us, just filled my prayers. And I was aware that the pain was lessening and the swelling was going down. As I continued to see myself as that beloved child with no burden of condemnation or pity or inadequacy, I felt the healing take place. In a little over an hour, I was on my feet, still a little swollen, but I could wear old, comfortable loafers, and I was on my way to the office. That night, I was in church. It was Wednesday, and I had high-heeled shoes on, and I honestly couldn't remember which foot it had been. I was completely free. I've never had any kind of problem at all with my feet from that experience. But you know what the sweetest healing was? Was what happened to my mothering. All of a sudden I found that there seemed to be more time. Things were being done with more ease and we were laughing again. We were having fun. And the whole attitude in our household changed. And then something rather interesting happened. It should be obvious, but sometimes we forget it. Children would rather help a happy mother than a grumbling mother. And the whole attitude in our house changed for months and months, and I went on to have more children. And from time to time, when that viewpoint of man is so burdened and so inadequate would begin to sweep in on me, I would remember that healing. Now, had you been there, you might have looked at that foot and said, yes, that foot's in a bad way. If you had been there that morning or the preceding few days, you might have said, she certainly looks too busy, and it certainly looks to me like she doesn't get enough help, et cetera, et cetera. But both of those were a mistaken viewpoint of man. And when the correct viewpoint of man was brought into the prayers and accepted in its thoroughness as valid, the healing took place. We constantly need to be asking ourselves, what is the viewpoint of man that I'm accepting right now? Sometimes we think we've done something like the prodigal trip. We thought something was going to work and we had a goal and the path we took missed the mark, was the wrong path, and we realized that instead of being filled full or fulfilled, we're very empty. The diet, the drugs, the exercise hasn't brought us the sense of well-being that we thought it would, physical well-being. The marriage, the children, the better job, the successful career, the children leaving, the great vacations, the better home, the retirement, all have taken place just as we thought we wanted, but there's still something empty in us. Maybe it's time to say goodbye to the pigs. Maybe it's time to look homeward, look Godward, away from the land of I want into the household of I have. And not going home as servants, not going home thinking we're going to still do something very holy and spiritual in order to get something, but going home, hearing those wonderful words, Son, thou art ever with me, and all I have is thine. Maybe we've never left. Maybe we've always done our very best to follow our highest understanding of the Christian teachings. but we've never quite understood. We kept thinking that the Christian way was the way in order to get something, and that we still didn't quite have enough good, and maybe someday we would. Maybe it's time to go all the way into the house. If we're feeling tendencies for meanness, for pettiness, for hurt, if we feel that life isn't just or fair, oh, how we see the elder brother feeling that. You can almost hear him saying, it's not fair. And there's lots of times in our life when it feels not fair. The good job we did, somebody else took credit for. The promotion we were promised, somebody else got. The raise we were promised was put on the shelf because of economic conditions. Something we tried to do among friends was misunderstood, and now there's some misunderstanding and some alienation there. Oh, the list goes on and on. Sometimes we even feel in our families that others perhaps get more love or more good than we do in our own human families. And if any of these things or related issues are there, it's time to go all the way in, to really join into the rejoicing, the blessedness, that quiet, deep joy that comes from knowing we are in the Father's house and all that He has. Not only all the supply, but all the intelligence, all the capability, all the inspiration, all the understanding, all the love, all the accomplishment, the purpose. The list goes on and all. The joy, the stability, the security, all of it is in the Father's house. And we need to go all the way in and accept the validity of man as the very child of God. It's a journey that takes only one step, and that's looking Godward and accepting the validity of man in the creation story in Genesis 1. All the way through that creation, we have that wonderful redundancy, and it was good, and it was good, and it was good at each stage of creation, and it was good, and it was good, and it was very good. That's where we are, in this all goodness in the Father's house. When I was preparing this talk early one morning, I opened again to a psalm that Christians everywhere love, the 23rd Psalm. And for the first time, I saw what seemed to me clear parallels between the prodigal story in the New Testament and the 23rd Psalm in the Old. And I would like to close with the reading of this psalm. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. One of the Bible definitions of the word restoreth in the original Hebrew is coming home. That completeness, the restoration that is in the Father's house. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for His name's sake. The term name means the nature of God. When we pray in His name, we pray in the nature. In the nature, the image and likeness of God, we are led in the paths of righteousness. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for Thou art with me. Thy rod and Thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil, consecration. My cup, inspiration, runneth over. Surely, goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Come home to the Father. Thank you.